to me, the thing that was, I think, intoxicating for me about climbing in general is you can't make a mistake. You can't step wrong. You can't climb into a rope wrong. You can't clip your carabiner into something wrong. There are no redos. There are no second chances.
There are no second chances on high stakes, high altitude mountains. But some people believe the biggest risks yield the biggest rewards. I'm Elizabeth Pearson Garr, and this is the Experience Podcast. On this episode, we experience something I definitely never will in my own life, summiting Mount Everest, the tallest mountain in the world, more than 29,000 feet high. My guest, Jeff Gottfirst, has been to Everest twice. You'll hear why. Everyone who climbs Everest has incredible stories. Jeff's are unique because in addition to everything else the mountain throws at climbers, Jeff has a condition called rheumatoid arthritis. He was the first person to ever summit Mount Everest with RA. I wanted to understand how and why he wanted to take on such an enormous challenge. Thank you so much for being here, Jeff. This podcast is about experiences that people have had that most of us haven't done or won't have the chance to do in our own lives. And I've got to admit that climbing Mount Everest is something that I would never do because I'm just not brave enough.
Yeah.
I feel like no matter how physically fit you could be, mentally fit, there's that element of risk involved.
Yeah.
What did you have in you that was willing to take that on?
I think the trait that I had in me, there was a couple of them. Number one, the will to succeed. And I also understood, as I live by in my personal life, measurable risk. You know, people thought like climbing Everest and climbing all these other seven summits are crazy. I didn't view it at that. I'm not a daredevil. You know, people would say to me, oh, it's great if I die on a mountain. You know, I died doing what I loved. And that was not my vantage point. I want to die in bed looking at my great-grandchildren. You know, that's the idea of climbing big mountains is about celebrating and learning amongst that journey. And after getting to the top of Everest, it really showed me that, well, initially I might have been climbing to saying like, look at me. When I got to the top of Everest, I realized I can see the world and what can I do to change it. You know, it really gave me great perspective on how small I was as an individual and being able to affect change in my life and other people's lives. And I would say that on all the mountains that I climbed, especially Everest, climbed with a lot of people who got there and would just say, not for me. You don't know the magnitude of that mountain and going through the Khumbu icefall and doing all those rotations. And you know, we had a teammate who died on our team. So, I mean, those are surreal things that,
wow.
Like if we were out hiking and you saw someone dead, you know, we'd stop hiking, you know, I mean, that's it. We're going home, we're dealing with that. Whereas you know, on Everest, when that happens, it's a more surreal thing because there is someone there, a human life. And I think for me, just, I have an ability to digest risk differently than other people. And I climbed a lot of people who'd get to Everest and would get, I don't know if you've ever seen the pictures of the ladders going over the crevasses. You know, they get to the first one in the Khumbu icefall and they just say, nope, I'm not going to do it.
You mentioned some people who get there and can't even get past base camp, maybe for acclimatizing or different reasons.
Yeah.
I read a quote from a woman who got there and said, getting through the ice falls is like slow dancing with the fat woman of fate in the ballroom of death. Does that resonate with you at all? Do you feel like the ice falls or any portion of it was just so harrowing that you felt like this is the part that I just can't keep going, or your resolve kept you moving forward?
I think a mountain like Everest has the ability to strip someone down to their true authentic selves. Where there's no facades. When I remember when I got to base camp the first time, I was like, the Himalayas are huge mountains. I mean, this is a different animal. I mean, this is different. I remember being awestruck at just how big it was. Just, I mean, I thought like the Cascades and Rainier was big. And when I got to the Himalayas, it was just like, and I'm actually going to climb this whole, you know, I mean, it was just really frightening, I guess. But I think when you get to that first ladder and you have to go over your first crevasse and put your crampons in and go, I think that's really a moment of truth. Like, you're definitely dancing with fate. And the question is, do you have the ability to push on? And not only push on once, I mean, push on over and over and over again through all these crevasses and all these ladders and so forth. I didn't have that feeling about the Khumbu icefall. I think that's a feeling just about mountaineering. It's not just about one specific component of getting to like that one part of the icefall, camp one to camp two. I understood what Everest was. And I understood that, hey, listen, if you're going to commit to doing this, you got to commit. You got to see it through. And it's dancing with fate the whole time on Everest, because there's a lot of things besides the icefall that could go wrong. Lot of things. And I can tell you, like, on my summit bid, and that when we're in the death zone, and they call that, that's 26 to 29,000 feet. You know, you read about that. You don't get to go experience that anywhere and kind of get ready for that. And in my summit bid, I can tell you, I lost my eyesight in my left eye at about 27,000 feet at a feature called the Balcony. And that was primarily because you leave Camp 4 in the death zone. We left at 8 o'clock at night, and within about an hour, my headlamp died. And there was, when you're up that high, there was no way I could take off my gloves to replace the battery. So I had to climb in front of my Sherpa using his headlamp to illuminate the route, but I had to take off my goggles because I couldn't see so well. So we went up in this big windstorm, so the wind just kept battering, it was coming from the left side, just kept battering my left eye. So I went blind in my left eye early into that summit bid and had to climb the whole way to the top of Everest from about 27 to 29,000 feet with one eye and all the way back down. And that summit bid from 26 to 29,000, we left at 8 o'clock on May 12th. We did not return to our tents until 9 o'clock on May 13th, you know, so we had 25 hours of climbing, and I climbed 23 of those with one eye, and then that was just back to Camp 4, then had to climb down the whole rest of the mountain with one eye. So,
and all the time not knowing if you were going to get your eyesight back?
Not at all, and my thought was, well, guess what, I got another one. It's okay. Got two of them.
Wow, that's pretty good perspective, Jack.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of my thought, but I mean, obviously, there was a fear there that when I lost the eyesight was, I'm very clear what happens if I would have lost the eyesight in the other. That would mean that someone else would be walking down my daughters down the aisle at their weddings if that happened. So I was very clear about what that meant. And for me, that moment of, okay, one eye is gone. Can I still get to the top, you know, and get back down? Because these aren't choices that are like, okay, hey, let me just go on my phone and order something off Amazon that saves this. You know, the umbilical right. cord is really stretched out really far. There is no umbilical cord to really at that juncture. So, but I was confident in my mindset and that I would probably say climbing Everest, especially when things get tough, it's, you know, probably, you know, 90% mental. You know, your head is saying don't go because you can't breathe. But, you know, you just have to be able to dig down deep and really want it. And I was pretty confident that I figured my right eye would hold up.
The temperature is what, negative?
It was probably negative 20. And then we had when we went up, there was a windstorm. So it even made it more problematic for us. But that also kept a lot of people off the mountain. There was only six of us climbing that day. So, you know, it was six Westerners and six Sherpas, so and we had the whole mountain to ourselves. I was on the summit by myself with my Sherpa, and as were the rest of my teammates and so forth, which doesn't always happen. There's a lot of times a lot of lines up there, and for us, none of that at all. It was a beautiful experience in that it was just us and climbing at our own pace, no people to worry about, and sitting up on top of the summit for the 2 minutes that we did.
Oh, you were only up there for 2 minutes? I was wondering how long you got to sit at the top of the world.
Yeah, we were only up there for literally two and a half minutes. And because once you're at the top, the journey's not done.
Right. I read that going down is actually more dangerous than getting up.
Yeah, and I think that's a number of reasons why that is. Number one, you're tired. Number two, gravitational pull. It's harder to climb down because you're being pulled down a little bit. And, you know, you've been climbing a long time. It's hard. It's a harder thing. And for me, it was equally as hard because I had lost the eyesight. I didn't have depth perception. So climbing down was a lesson in leaning over and looking at every single step, trying to figure out where do I place my crampon, crampon are the spikes on the bottom of your boots.
And over on one side, is it just a steep drop? Like if you take a wrong step?
Yeah, and there are steep drops along that whole way at certain parts. And, you know, to me, the thing that was, I think, intoxicating for me about climbing in general is you can't make a mistake. You can't step wrong. You can't climb into a rope wrong. You can't clip your carabiner into something wrong. There are no redos. There are no second chances. You know, it's a very, you can't do anything wrong on Everest or on any other mountain, because if you do something wrong, it means you don't get to come back. And that's not the point of climbing, in my opinion. The point is to come back, celebrate, and apply what you've learned to, you know, the people around you, and to, if you have children, to your children and to your friends and family, and how they can maybe glean something from it.
Can you describe what it was like when you were at the top for those 2 minutes?
I would say those 2 minutes at the top were two things. If I can get down, everything in my life after this will be gravy. And the second thought was, get down. I have one eye. I have to get down. I want to celebrate this with my wife and with my kids. To be honest, I really didn't celebrate until I landed back stateside, because I knew there was a lot to do and climbing. So I was ecstatic about being at the top. I took a video, and it was a lot smaller than I had imagined. I'll put it that way.
How big is it about? I read it's about the size of a dining table.
The top, I don't know, 10 feet. You know, I just remember that last, like, 50 feet to the top as it was just getting smaller and smaller. And I was like, this is getting, it's like, I thought this was going to be, you know, rather large, but it was quite small, in my opinion, when I got up there.
And there are a bunch of flags up there, is that right?
Yeah, there's a bunch of Buddhist flags, and I put up pictures of my wife and kids that I took a video of, that they were on top of the world. And I was ecstatic, but I knew that if I was going to live the rest of my life like a champion, that I had to get down. And I knew that I had a big struggle going down, because, again, I had one eye. And I could feel that the other eye was maybe starting to get a little bad. So I knew that time was of the essence, and that it was going to be a lot harder climbing down. There was going to be a major struggle. When I was on Everest, I really figured out what happens when you die. And you know what it is? The people who love you will miss you. You know, that to me was my vantage point of climbing. I wasn't, the risk of me climbing, I didn't take it as an individual, like, if I die, this is going to happen. I worried about those people, the people who love me the most. My wife and kids and my parents and my friends are going to miss me. And to me, I think climbing Everest gave me a very unfair advantage in the business I'm in now, because the risk I face every day in a startup in our life cycle doesn't scare me. You know, I've already dealt with something really scary, climbing every day knowing I can die at every minute. There's only so much you can mitigate, especially on Everest. You can mitigate having good equipment. You can mitigate being in pretty good shape. But being in good shape doesn't really dictate how altitude's going to affect you. Or
the winds, or a sudden change in weather, or an avalanche.
100%. I mean, it was very interesting. Even a couple of years after I climbed Everest, there was a major earthquake on Everest. And I had a friend who died at base camp during the earthquake. A rock came in, hit him, and he passed away. You know what I mean? And that's where you think, you know, that can happen on Everest when you're in your tent. And I remember my first night when I got to Everest the first time, in my first tent, and you would hear these major thunderstorms. And then, like, my Sherpa, great guy who I was climbing with, he said, those aren't thunderstorms, those are avalanches. Wow. You know, and you're like, what? Like, what do you mean? And you're like, those are avalanches, you know, in the surrounding mountains. So, you know, for me, I had climbed Everest twice. I didn't make it the first time. The first time I climbed in 2010, I had some altitude issues up at about 23,000 feet that were affecting me.
What did that feel like? You just physically couldn't keep going on?
I was having some high altitude cold air induced asthma attacks.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it was almost like climbing in altitude was already hard, but it was almost like constricted to like a straw. And I could not breathe at 23,000 feet. And I knew obviously if I went further, I would pass away. So I had always understood that I lived by this thing, mountains endure, not so much people. And I knew that Everest would always be there. So I knew when I didn't feel good, even though that was a punch in the teeth and I'd have to train all over again. And I mean, it was really hard to kind of come to that decision. But you know, as I'm saying it, I remember being at Camp 3 and looking to the top of Everest, turning my back and saying, like, this is not my year. I need to sort this issue out before I come back again. And turned back, went back home, trained harder, figured out how to deal with the high altitude cold air induced asthma. And when I got back up to 23,000 the second time, it was like, uh-oh, is it going to happen again?
Yeah, the mental game kicks in.
The mental game, you know, and I think those are things that, you know, I just have this ability to push through those obstacles and handle those situations in a manner that I lean into risk like it's chocolate milk. And I just try to just be measurable in that risk. But
so when it didn't work out the first time, did you know right away, I'm coming back, this isn't over for me?
The moment I took this first step down, I knew that I was going to come back. I knew I would do the things to figure out why was this happening. Because Everest was something that I always wanted to climb as a young child. And I just knew I was going to go back. I was determined to do it. I was determined to get to the top. And rightly or wrong, when I got home the first time, I did feel like a failure. I really did. I was like, I didn't make it. And, you know, my wife, Emily, was like, you're not a failure. You turned, you know, you're doing things that most people, you know, they're not going to actually go out and try to do this. And I felt like a failure, though. I was like, I didn't do it. But, I got over that rather quickly. And I was just even more determined to go into that dark cave every day of training because I knew it held the treasure that I wanted. And I knew that treasure was getting to the top and back down and learning all those lessons along the way that I knew that I'd be able to apply back on terra firma, back on solid ground, you know, in my everyday life and so forth. So
what does that training look like, preparing for it?
Yeah, what I would do was 5 days a week. And I did this for 10 years. You know, climbing Everest wasn't just, hey, I'm going to go climb Everest. Everest started with climbing Mount Whitney, then climbing Mount Rainier, then going down to Mexico and climbing the highest mountains there. Then I went to Russia and climbed Mount Elbrus. Then Aconcagua, which is in South America, which is the highest mountain outside of the Himalayas at 23,000 feet. So that journey was not just, hey, I'm climbing Everest, I'm going to go do that. That took 10 years of climbing and training. And the training that I would do, and again, this just is what worked for me, I would hike in the Los Altos Preserve. There's a 3,000-foot mountain there called the Black Mountain. And I think it was 12 miles round trip, and it's a 3,000-foot elevation gain. I would hike that with 35 pounds of water in my pack.
Oh my goodness.
And I would dump the water at the top to make it easier coming down. And I would do that in 2.5 hours. So I wasn't hiking as in, you know, slow hiking. I was kind of jogging going up to the best of my, and then I was running coming down. I do that on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And then on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I would go to a college called Foothill Community College. And on the football field, I would do interval training. And what that meant was from the end zone to the other end zone line, which is, you know, 120 yards if you include the end zones, I would sprint that as hard, fast as I can, getting my heart rate up. And then around the corner, I would drop to a jog to bring my heart rate down. And then I would sprint the 100 again. And I would do that 100 times.
100 times?
100 times each Tuesday and Thursday. So that, again, that would just greatly elevate the heart rate. You know, bam, bang it up. And then bring it down a little, bang it up.
My goodness.
And that's what I did for my trainer. It depends on where you live and what you do, but that's what really worked for me and for getting my cardiovascular system ready and my legs. Because I knew, especially when I went back to Everest the second time, I knew there was never an issue with my legs, meaning that I knew my legs were going to get me through wherever I needed to go. And I knew that when that eye went, I knew, I just said, my legs will get me there. And not slow legs, you know, not like, hey, I can take 50 hours to do that. I knew my legs were muscle memory. You know, I knew they knew what to do. And that's what I think allowed me to get up to the top with the one eye and get back down. When we talk about all those things, having one eye, climbing in the death zone, not being able to breathe, it's cold, you're tired, you haven't, you know, we didn't rest for that 25 hours. And you know, I also have rheumatoid arthritis.
Yeah, how did that affect everything? How did you deal with that through this entire climb?
You know, I have the ability to handle suffering. And guess what? You know, people often ask me, why do you do it? And I think when I was climbing Everest, putting my feet on the floor every morning were for the people I knew who couldn't do that. I know there's people who have my affliction, who have rheumatoid arthritis, as well as other conditions and diseases, who are at home and they can't do things. You know, they just can't, and that's not their fault. You know, they're just not able to do that. And for me, I was like, I can do it. I can endure the pain. I can endure the suffering. That's great. And it still gets me out every day in the morning when I put my feet on the floor, because I know there's people who are climbing Everest with a really rough affliction that affects, for me personally, my toes, my ankles, my knees, and my hips. That's predominantly what we're using to climb a mountain.
Not to mention all the training. I mean, you dealt with that pain through all the training as well, I'm sure.
All the training and every day, still do every day. So that was an added obstacle to have to endure. You know, I was fortunate that, you know, maybe I've just been lucky. I have a characteristic that helps me digest pain and suffering different than other people. You know, if someone feels pain and they're at a 10, well, and they have to stop, I'm at a 10, but I think I can push till it's a 50, you know, and that's just something that, you know, I'm just lucky that I'm able to do that. But to be honest with you, not getting to the top the first time was probably the most valuable part of the journey, because when I got to the top the second time and you know, got back down, back stateside, it made the victory even better. I know a lot of people who go to Everest and they don't make it their first time, and guess what? They don't go back. You know, they just don't, because it takes lots of determination, lots of tenacity, lots of energy, the ability to handle a lot of suffering.
And the atmospheric pressure up there is one-third what it is at sea level, so
yeah,
the oxygen you're getting is one-third of the oxygen you're normally getting. And it takes so long. Is this right? I read that that last mile can take 12 hours to climb.
Yeah, I mean, we took 25 hours, that 26,000 to 20, that's 3,000 feet. But that last 3,000 feet, and remember, that's not 3,000 feet, it's 6,000 feet, because you got to go up and down.
And back. So that's just an incredible feat. And there you are with one eye, and you're struggling with oxygen, even with the supplemental.
And you can't breathe. And I mean, and I almost put it, it's like running with a straw in your mouth and a bag on your head. It's just really hard to breathe. And that altitude is the great equalizer. You know, that you can go as trained as you are and with the greatest attitude, but if that altitude hits you, and it hits people, I mean, it kills people.
So what's the process when you decide you want to go? Do you have to get a permit? Do you sign up with a guide, or how do you find the Sherpas?
Yeah, you know, I think when you want to begin that journey, there's some steps you have to take, especially because hiking is not mountain climbing, mountaineering. Those are two different sports. Mountaineering is different in that it entails altitude, it entails crevasses, avalanche, how to cook with melted ice, how to carry big loads. I mean, it's just a different thing. So when I started, I had climbed Mount Whitney as a kid during the summer. So that's just a hike, basically. But then I went and climbed Mount Rainier, and that was my real taste of mountaineering and of how to do it, how to survive climbing, how to sleep at night. What do you deal with going to the bathroom and you got to come out of your tent at night on steep terrain, dealing with all of the equipment, getting accustomed to layering and how to deal with that, with taking breaks. What do? Do you put on jackets? Do you put on more gloves? You know, so there is this.
Can you go into some of that? I really am interested in that. I mean, I've watched a lot of documentaries in Everest and all that.
Yeah.
What do you wear? What do you carry in your pack? And how do you sleep at night in these steep places?
It varies in different mountains. On Everest, our base camp was at 17,000 feet. Then our camp one, and you do what are called rotations on Everest. So you just don't climb Everest and go from Kathmandu to the top of Everest. You have to acclimate as you're doing this. So it takes us 2 weeks to hike into Everest base camp. And you have to spend 2 weeks hiking to base camp, and base camp is at 17,000 feet. Then you'll climb up to camp one at 19,000 feet, spend a couple nights, then back down to base camp. Then you'll spend like three nights down there. Then you climb back up to camp one for three nights. Then you go up to camp two for three nights. Then you'll climb all the way back down for five nights. Then you'll repeat that. Then you go up to camp three. So it's this. So when people see like ladders, they think you're just going over like 30 ladders once. You're really going over like 200 ladders because you're doing it so many times. And your tent and your sleeping are different at different parts of the mountain. At base camp, you have kind of your own tent and you have your supplies in there, and you're able to have more in there. As the higher you go, you have less with you. You know, you just carry less about what you're going to do. And you know, it's a learning process, but there's, you can read any book and or any magazine or any guides that you're with, and you know, you'll take these necessities with you, which are obviously, you know, whatever, you know, your crampons, your ice axe, your different layers, your different sets of goggles. I mean, but like I indicated to you, my headlamp died, and there's nothing to stop that. Maybe you have an extra headlamp. I did have an extra headlamp, but I lost it somewhere along the way, you know, just in the process of climbing with an oxygen mask on and so forth. And those are the things that you have to adapt to. After climbing for those 25 hours and getting into my tent that night, and upon stopping, it was very apparent that within an hour, things were going to go bad for me because my clothes were wet from sweating, and I was going to become hypothermic from being wet, and now sitting still in a tent, and you know, having to adjust and figure out, okay, all I want to do is go to bed, but now I got to figure out who on my team has some clean, you know, has some dry clothes that I can wear, because I'm not going to make it through the night. I remember only a couple people had some clothes I could wear, and I was so cold that night that I actually put my gloves on my feet, because it was just, you know, it was so.
What an anecdote.
But those are the things that you just don't, you can't prepare for. Like, you just can't prepare for losing an eye. You can't prepare for, on that summit bid, there was a Japanese guy who had passed away at about 28,000 feet, and seen that body up there just hooked into a rope, just, and he had gotten either HACE or HAPE, those are called. HACE is high altitude cerebral edema. HAPE is high altitude pulmonary edema, and when you do that, you have a tendency to think you're hot and you take your clothes off. So he was up on the top, like pretty close to the top, with, you know, his down suit unzipped, his gloves off, all of his layers off, and you know, and seeing those things are you know, surreal things as you're doing the same thing he's doing.
It makes me think of the Sherpas, because it is nice to have comrades in arms there. And these guys have climbed many, many times. What are your thoughts about the role of the Sherpas on the mountain?
Yeah, I think number one, you know, people think that the word Sherpa is associated with someone who carries things, and that's not what it is. The Sherpa are the native people to the Khumbu region of that part of the Himalayas. You know, and obviously some of them are still in Tibet, and some of them are on that, in that Khumbu Valley. It's called the Solo Khumbu region. And they are a magnificent, humble people. And especially as we would hike into base camp, you would stop by these Buddhist monasteries and go in there. And I mean, it was just an incredible lesson for me, seeing a warm, easy people where, you know, they might not have the luxuries that there are no cars up in that area. There's no a lot of things. Let me put it that way. I conned with a wonderful, wonderful Sherpa whose name was Denuru, and we climbed that mountain together, and his ability to know the mountain and, you know, here's where we go, here's what we're going to do, and, you know, I think that was refreshing. I would also say on that summit bit, obviously, we're wearing oxygen masks. Because it was so windy, those oxygen masks have like a regulator on the side that's kind of open to the wind, so it releases the CO2 when you breathe, you know, so it goes out. And that was freezing on that night of the summit bid. So about every 15 minutes, Denuru or I would have to take off our mask, and we would put our mouth on the other person's mask and blow into it to clear it. I mean, it's like right here on your mouth. So, I mean, you're getting like the inner workings of the person next to you. We had to do that for 10 hours doing that.
A very intimate experience with each other.
And those are experiences, again, that you don't get to learn about. It was just like, hey, how are we going to make this work to pull this off? So I think for me personally, I learned a lot from the Sherpa people. And, you know, I've hoped that what I learned, I've brought that humility back to what I do in my professional life, as well as with my personal life with my wife and my children. And getting to the top is great, but to me, it's seeing the world and how you want to change it is what matters. It's not about, hey, this is what I've done.
A practical question. What do you eat? How do you eat while you're climbing?
That's a wonderful question. And I definitely was a lot skinnier when I was climbing, because I now get to eat McDonald's and French fries every time I want, because I celebrate.
But easier access to food right
100%.
Now.
100%. For me, when I was climbing, when you get up in altitude, your appetite changes. So for me, what I love to eat was candy. I don't eat candy ever. So I'd get everything from Milky Ways, Hershey's, Twix, M&M's, Jolly Ranch. I mean,
like Halloween every day.
This huge bag, and that's all I would eat, was just be candy. I didn't eat.
Not protein and healthy food?
No, because you don't need the protein. You need energy. You don't want to burn sugar.
Oh.
You know, you're just burning. So you got to keep the tank going. So protein is great for, of course, muscle building. And at base camp, yeah, I might have. We had a tendency to have a lot of spam. So I might have a...
These are some of the most unexpected answers. Yeah. You ate candy
and
spam.
Yeah, so I'd have like a little spam at base camp. But other than that, it was, oh my gosh, 100 gram bars, Nestle Crunch, Smarties. You know, Smarties.
Oh yeah, Smarties.
I mean, Smarties I would just throw in my mouth, and I would literally just take a swig of water and just... It's just sugar. You know, just keeps you going and so forth. I remember when I... After 2 months, because the trip is 2 months of climbing, when I got back, when I flew from Kathmandu to Hong Kong, the only thing I wanted after 2 months was milk. They had like a Ben and Jerry's in the airport in Hong Kong. And all I did between my flights was just eat ice cream. You know, my body just yearned having, you know, that calcium. But for me, on every climb, it's always been candy and lots of it.
When you're at the height of where jets are flying, which is where you were, you're going for candy.
You're going for candy and just Jolly Ranchers and Swedish fish. Oh my gosh. And gummy bears and cola bottle.
So before I let you go, I'd like to circle back. You mentioned you learned so many lessons while you were on Everest. Can you share some of those with me?
Yeah, I think the main lessons I learned are, number one, don't let anyone walk through your mine with dirty feet. I think that was something that really, that I still apply today in my daily life. That most of the people who are criticizing you are people who are doing nothing. I think that is something that I live with. I also live by a great Muhammad Ali quote that I love. It's not the mountain that wears you out, it's often the pebble in your shoe. And I think the last one is, the dark cave you fear often holds the treasure that you want. Not to be a broken record, you know, you climb mountains not so people can see you, you climb so you can see the world and change it. And that was my experience on Everest, and that's, and as well as other mountains, and that's what I've learned, and that's what drives me forward every single day, and I consider myself very lucky. I know there's a lot of unfortunate souls that lose their life mountaineering, and they don't get to celebrate like I get to, and, you know, continue life.
Well, thank you so much. This has been so enlightening for me.
Great.
I really appreciate you telling me about this because, like I said, I'm never going to climb Mount Everest, so I really appreciate experiencing it vicariously through you.
Well, it was a pleasure. I'm glad, glad it was interesting. Thank you.
I am simply in awe of people who take on such huge physical and emotional challenges. I can't imagine ever climbing to the summit of Mount Everest. But still, much of what Jeff said resonated with me. Here are my takeaways from our conversation. Number one, not achieving a goal on the first try is sometimes a blessing. Keep trying. Victory tastes even sweeter the second, or third, or eighth time around. Two, preparation is key, but you can't mitigate for every possibility. Three, be adaptable. Sometimes you need to wear your friend's dry clothes and wear your gloves on your feet to keep warm. 4. If you're going to commit to something, like climbing Mount Everest or something else in life, see it through. And finally, number 5. Even if you're on top of the world, literally or figuratively, the important thing isn't that you're there. It's what you can do to change it for the better. I'd like to thank Jeff Gottfirst for sharing his inspiring stories with me. If you'd like to learn more about Jeff and his new company, go to cyberdive.co. Please visit our website, theexperiencepodcast.net, to explore other episodes, sign up for our insiders list and newsletter, and find out how to follow us on social media. And if you liked what you heard, please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast. It helps others discover us. I'm Elizabeth Pearson Garr. Thanks for joining in the experience.